begin our second portion of our classes this morning. We're going to read from 1 Samuel 17, verses 20 to 45. 1 Samuel 17, verse 20 to 45. And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, have ye seen this man that is come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why comest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thy heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And he turned from him toward another and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him again after the former manner. And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he went for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him, for thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. And David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, moreover, Yahweh that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and Yahweh be with thee. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put an helmet of brass upon his head, and he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he assuaged to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose him five smooth stones out of the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy, and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of Yahweh of armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. So we'll now turn our attention again to Brother David
Good morning again, everyone. We'll pick up with verses 20 through 22 here in our second class. David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. In these verses, first thing we notice is that David rises up early in the morning. We won't take the time to look at cross references, but this is a biblical habit of faithful men. If you look at Genesis 19, 21, and 23, we see Abraham, this recorded of Abraham multiple times there. It's recorded of Jacob in Genesis 28, and recorded of Joshua in Joshua chapter 3, chapter 6, chapter 7, and chapter 8. So again, Abraham, Jacob, Joshua, David. In any case, David got up and off to work, making sure the sheep were taken care of. He was, as we just sang, that loving shepherd of his sheep. Always a primary concern of David's, no matter what stage of life he was facing. As we go through our studies of David, I've mentioned this before and I'll mention it again. Throughout his entire life, David was a shepherd of sheep first and a shepherd of men second. Little did David know, though, how important this time with the sheep was and how his life would literally turn in another direction from this time and onward. There had certainly been momentous days in his life already, such as the day that Samuel anointed him or the day when Saul called him up to the court of the king. But the events in the Valley of Elah would change everything for David permanently as the young man was suddenly thrust upon the national stage. The 1 Samuel 16 events, both with Samuel and Saul, were relatively private, were relatively with a small circle of people that would know about these things. But once the events of 1 Samuel 17 happen, David is thrust onto the national stage. And again, he would never be able to escape that, that he was a central figure of Israel from this point to his very death. By divine providence, we find that David reached the trench exactly at the right time, when the Philistine champion came out to fight after 40 days. Again, the timing was perfect. What did David do then? Did he hesitate? No. He ran into the army to salute his brethren. He leaves his carriage, which just basically means his stuff, behind. We are reminded then of how we should act in the battle with sin. This is a phrase that's easy to overlook, putting the carriage, putting the stuff behind to go to the battlefield. But there's an important spiritual lesson here. We'd like to look at a few cross references. Philippians chapter 3, 13 and 14. Philippians 3, 13 and 14. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, or which means seized, but this thing, one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind. He put away the stuff of his old life. He didn't really know yet to the full extent that that stuff will be put behind, but he reaches forward unto those things which are before. I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we are also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, those men and women that we read about earlier in our first class, let us lay aside every weight, all of our carriage, all of our stuff, and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. So in Philippians 3, verses 13 and 14, and Hebrews 12, 1, we see this principle of leaving the things of the past behind. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisies and envies and all evil speakings, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word, that ye may grow thereby. If so be, ye have tasted that the Lord is gracious. So again, we are to lay aside the things of the flesh. Lay aside every weight. So this is what David did. And he soon got his first taste of Goliath, that great giant of the flesh. And he also got his first taste of the faithlessness of the men of Israel, who were all fleeing from that giant in fear. Back in 1 Samuel 17, verses 23 to 25, "And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and came according to the same words, and spake according to the same words. And David heard them. And when all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, Have ye seen this man that's come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel." Some of the men point out to David, who obviously would have been confused and angered by the events, that the giant was here to defy Israel. You think about David seeing this great event. He is, again, he's a young man, teenager, stripling, youth. We don't know exactly his age, but let's just say 13, 14, 15, 16, somewhere in that range. But he is obviously, from his youth, we've already seen and will continue to see, a young man of great faith. And so here he is. He sees the giant coming, and the entire army is fleeing from the giant. We'll see, of course, David's reaction in this chapter and what he will do about it. But the men also tell him not only about what's going on here, but they also note that whoever kills Goliath will be given riches, Saul's daughter Merab, who is the princess, and his father's house will be made free in Israel, with the word in here for freedom indicating freedom from bondage, taxes, or cares. So basically, whoever won this battle is going to have a happy, pleasant life. In this statement, we actually get a glimpse, though, into the mind of Saul that I don't want to overlook. His mind was divorced from Yahweh. And instead of going to prayer or utilizing the whole armor of God, instead of doing what Deuteronomy had commanded him to do to get the priest to give this exhortation, Saul had devised a scheme that would provoke a hopeful champion via the lust of the eye, Merab the princess, the lust of the flesh, riches, and the pride of life, an elevated status in Israel. That is what these three things represent. There are three items. One represents the lust of the eye. The second represents the lust of the flesh. And then the pride of life. This is how the mind of Saul worked. These, of course, were the three enemies that all of us should be striving to battle against. And he should have been motivating them, again, based on the fact that Yahweh, their creator, was with them if they had been with him. Remember those evening and morning sacrifices. We won't take the time to read it, but in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11, Jesus battles these three temptations, these three trials: the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And what did he do? Every time he was tried or tempted, he overcame with a, "Thus saith the Lord." You know, "Thus saith the Lord, man shall not live by bread alone. Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God," and so forth and so on. But Saul was using these lusts, these things that are natural to the human mind, to encourage his men instead of having them cut off those things of the flesh and to work in the ways of the Spirit. 1 Samuel 17, 26 to 29. "David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Now, he had already been told what was to be done, so it's interesting that he says this again, but he's speaking to the men, and we have some thoughts on this in a second. He's speaking to the men around him. "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him after this manner, saying, "So shall it be done to the man that killeth him." And Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why comest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thy heart. Thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." And David said, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" In these verses, we see David asking curious questions regarding the Philistine he just witnessed. His allure to the battle scene was not the temptations of the flesh, but instead a zeal for Yahweh. Note his language. It wasn't, "Wow, I really want to be the son-in-law of the king. I really want to be rich. No, David says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? This should make us think about words that are recorded in some of the Psalms. Let's turn over to Psalm chapter 69, verse 9. Psalm 69, verse 9. The zeal of thy house hath eaten me up, and the reproaches of them that reproach thee are fallen upon me. Here was a man relatively alone in that day, and his mind was zealous for Yahweh. Psalm 119, verse 139. My zeal hath consumed me, because my enemies have forgotten thy words. And we, of course, know the over in the New Testament, let's just look at it, John chapter 2, verses 13 to 17. For this, of course, is a pattern which Christ himself followed. John 2, 13, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And again, he goes to see his brethren, you might say. What does he discover? He discovers that everything is wrong. And found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple and the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overthrew the table and said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my father's house a house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. Sadly, what was man's reaction to David's zealous prodding? Just like with Jesus, back in 1 Samuel, we see David's brother, Eliab, berating him. This, remember, is the same Eliab that had seen his brother anointed many days before in Bethlehem, Judah. Yet that event obviously had not sunk into this man's heart. Again, David was the anointed king. His brother saw that he was the anointed king. Interestingly, Eliab means, my God is Father. My God is Father. It makes us think of the family of Jesus, both the literal family and the nation of Israel itself and his generation. They proclaim themselves the people or family of God. My God is Father. Unfortunately, though, they both hated and shamed those with true zeal for God, including the man that had been publicly anointed with the Holy Spirit at the Jordan. Let's look at Mark chapter 3. Verse 21. Mark 3, verse 21. And when his friends heard of it, and you might have see in your margin that friends could also be translated kinsmen. When his friends or his kinsmen heard of it, that's probably a better translation, they went out to lay hold on him, and they said, he is beside himself. Talking about Christ. John chapter 10, verse 20. It wasn't Jesus' true friends that were getting him to stop. It was his kinsmen. It was his literal family that do not understand what he was doing. John 10, verse 20 says, and many of them said, he hath a devil and is mad. Why hear ye him? In John 15, verse 25. But this cometh to pass, that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. Sadly, both the generation of Christ and the generation in David's time played the fool in their anger against Yahweh's anointed ones. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 7, verse 9. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 9. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. And that is exactly what Eliab was doing, and that is exactly what, at least in that situation, Jesus' own brethren and family were doing. Back in 1 Samuel, let's look at 29 through 31. David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And he turned from him toward another, and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him again after the former manner. So what David's doing, and to get sort of a picture in your mind, is he's going around the camp, and he's asking these questions, the questions in verse 26. What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? He's going about the camp trying to stir up the people with these questions. In verse 31, when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. So hopefully we'll be able to piece this all together. In these verses, starting at verse 29, David defends himself first. Where he says in verse 29, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? Moffat says in his translation, what have I done now? I merely asked a question. The Jerusalem Bible says, what have I done? Must I not even speak? The New English Translation has, what have I done now? Can't I say anything? Obviously, David was a bit exasperated. He was bewildered now, not only by Goliath's wickedness, but also by Israel's complete lack of faith and the ill reception he was receiving from his brethren. Verses 30 and 31 seem to show us that the questions that David posed in verse 26 were an attempt to rouse up the people. And it's interesting, the two questions that he asks would really play differently depending on what type of recipient was hearing them. The first question was more of a question that would play to the natural man, and the second question is one that would play more to the spiritual man. It seems, in a way, that David was laying the net wide open, just as Paul did, as he recorded in 1 Corinthians 9, verses 20 to 27. I think this is just an interesting thing to ponder. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 20 through 27. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without the law, as without the law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things unto all men, that I might by all means save some. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. Know ye not then that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things, but they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so fight, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So Paul was known for essentially laying the net wide open. To the Jews, he came as a Jew. To those under the law, he came as under the law. To the weak, he came as the weak, and so forth and so on. He altered his preaching, you might say, not the fundamentals of the gospel, but he altered the approach that he took depending on whoever that recipient was. Going back to the time of David in 1 Samuel 17, the net was laid wide open by David as he went throughout the camp trying to encourage the men. Some might be more encouraged by the marital prospects, whereas hopefully at least a few would be more interested, like he was, in Yahweh's name. David's priority clearly was, though, again, on Yahweh's name. Sadly, from person to person to person, David went throughout the camp with no results, until at last his actions brought him to the attention of Saul. And I think we have to maybe read between the lines here. David was going throughout the camp so much that it brought attention upon him from the king. This wasn't just a simple, I'm going to ask five people these questions. He's going through the camp trying to encourage the Israelites to essentially buck up, to have faith, to get going. David had been seeking for the army to simply do their job for God and for Israel, but having failed, and no doubt due to divine providence, he soon found himself back in the presence of King Saul. Let's look at verses 32 and 33. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight him. Thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. David, now in the court of the king again, exhorts Saul. What a scene should flash through our minds. Here was a stripling youth giving an exhortation to the much older king of Israel. King Saul, sadly, was not an elder who ruled well. You know, we think about 1 Timothy 5:17. Nonetheless, David, amazingly, both now and throughout his life, gave honor to the king nonetheless. Just I'll look at that verse real quick. 1 Timothy 5, verse 17. It says, "Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in word and doctrine." What's amazing about David is throughout his life, Saul was not an elder that ruled well. He was not worthy of double honor, and yet David still gave it to him, despite the fact it was extremely undeserving of it. It's a testament to David's character that he would treat him like this. In fact, David strove to encourage Saul. He says, "Let no man's heart fail because of him." This should remind us all of the words of Christ in John chapter 14. Let's look at verse 1 and verse 27. John chapter 14, verse 1 and 27. "Let not your heart be troubled. Let no man's heart fail because of him. Believe in God, believe also in me." Verse 27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled. Let no man's heart fail because of him. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." So what was David thinking of then? Why was his heart not troubled when he saw Goliath on the battlefield? His attitude was that of what we'll see in Romans 8, verse 31. Romans 8, 31. "What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us?" 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. "For whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world, and this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith." David knew that Yahweh was with him, and thus his response to King Saul was swift. "Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Sadly, Saul looked on only the outward appearance instead of the heart, absent of that great lesson of chapter 16. Saul could only see a youth, a boy. He did not see courage, faith, trust in Yahweh that this teenager had. We would like to look at the verse a bit out of context for a second. We'd like to look at this coming verse a bit out of context, but let's look at 2 Corinthians 4:18. 2 Corinthians 4:18. "While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal." In the context of our subject this morning, David possessed those characteristics required of Yahweh's servants. In 2 Corinthians 4:18, it says, basically, not those things that are seen, but rather those characteristics that are eternal. That's what David possessed. If you looked at him, even though, yes, we read there was he had some great characteristics, physically speaking, as recorded in chapter 16, but still, he was a young youth. And that is what Saul saw in front of him. But David possessed those characteristics which are unseen, which are eternal. Saul was simply blind and could not see in terms of the things of the Spirit. Okay. Returning to the text, let's go look at verses 34 to 36, in which we're starting to get into some very key details. "David said to Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and there took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and cut it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and I smote him and slew him. The servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God." David was very quick to respond to King Saul's concerns. He discusses his work as a shepherd boy protecting the sheep. As we have discussed in a previous talk, David, like Joseph and Moses and Amos, had all been prepared for a much greater work by their time as a shepherd. So too, of course, with the greater David in symbol. Let's look at John chapter 10, 9 through 16. John chapter 10, 9 through 16. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal and to kill and to destroy. Think of the lion and the bear. I am come that they might have life, but they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. We read it, we sang earlier, hymn 106, the loving shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep, but he that is a hireling and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming, just like a lion or a bear, and leaveth the sheep and fleeth, and the wolf catcheth them and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth because he is a hireling and cares not for the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and know my sheep, and am known of mine. As the Father knoweth me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one fold and one shepherd. Truly like Jesus, David was willing to lay his life down for his sheep, as illustrated in the examples that he gives. He would tell King Saul how he had literally risked his life and limb to protect literal sheep. It would be far easier to say, oh, well, let the lion and the, or the bear have the lamb, and, you know, I'll take care of everybody else. But no, David took on the bear, took on the lion. He laid down his life in type for the people of Israel by going down to do battle. Just Jesus, of course, I'm gonna clarify. David would lay down his life, risking life and limb to protect the literal sheep. Jesus was about to lay his life down in type for the people of Israel by going down to battle with the giant of sin, typical of Messiah's much greater work. Note that the two animals that are specifically mentioned are a lion and a bear. Other translations make it look like this actually may have been a regular occurrence. In other words, not just a one-time thing. Regardless, our minds, when we think of a lion and a bear, should ultimately bring us to Bible prophecy. Let's look at Daniel chapter 7, verses 3 through 5. Daniel chapter 7, verses 3 through 5. And the four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet of a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. And behold, another beast, a second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. In this chapter, we see the lion of Babylon and the bear of Medo-Persia. But in the ultimate sense, looking to Armageddon, we think of the two great powers that will stand against the Lord Jesus Christ when he returns. First, Jesus will face the Russian bear, and then he will face the lion of Babylon the Great. Both will come to their just ends at the hands of the Good Shepherd. So we'll look at some verses to prove this point. First, the Russian bear, Daniel 11:45. And he, that is the king of the north, led by Russia, will plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So this is the Russian bear being spoken of here. Also, the Russian bear over in Ezekiel 39, verses 1 through 5. Ezekiel chapter 39, 1 to 5. Therefore, thou son of man, prophesy against Gog, and say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back, and leave but the sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come up from the north parts, and will bring thee unto the mountains of Israel. I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, into the beasts of the field to be devoured, and thou shalt fall upon the open field, for I have spoken it, saith the Lord God. So here we see the Russian bear that was will be taken down. So what's the other animal? This is the lion. Likewise, we see the Babylonian lion. Let's look at Revelation 14, 7 and 8, where that Babylonian lion will also be taken down. Revelation 14, 7 and 8, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she hath made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. In Revelation 18, verse 2, he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and a hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Okay, so we've prophetically speaking, the lion and the bear represent the Babylonian lion and the Russian bear. Let's go back now to the scene at Saul's headquarters, looking at verses 36 and 37. David says, thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, moreover, Yahweh hath delivered me out of the paw of the lion, and out of the paw of the bear he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and Yahweh be with thee. Just as the lion and the bear had proved no match for David, the young shepherd believed that the Philistine champion would also fall. Note that this was not due to self-confidence on the part of David, but supreme confidence in Yahweh. David thus says that Goliath hath defied the armies of the living God. It would be interesting to have read the mind of Saul at that point. Saul might have viewed the trembling Israelite bands as the armies of the living God. But David's thoughts were much higher. In the ultimate sense, while yes, Israel's armies should have been the armies of the living God, I think what David is referring to is much higher. He is referring to Yahweh Elohim, or Yahweh Tzevaoth, that innumerable company of angels whose name has been defied. We can see their manifestation throughout the scriptures, but we want to look at one particular example from the life of Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 10 through 17. These are the armies that have been defied. 2 Kings 6, 10 through 17. And the king of Israel sent to the place which the man of God told him and warned him of, and saved himself there not once or twice. Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled for this thing. He called his servants and said unto them, will ye not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? So the king of Syria here keeps on trying to attack Israel, and everything he does is thwarted. And he's wondering, is there a spy or a traitor in their midst? Verse 12, and one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the king of the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words thou speakest in thy bedchambers. And he said, go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, behold, he is in Dothan. Therefore sent he thither horses and chariots and a great army. And they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an army compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, alas, my master, how shall we do? And he answered, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. Of course, as the sort of like King Saul, the servant was thinking more on the natural. He was probably shocked. What are you talking about, Elisha? Verse 17, and Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. And Yahweh opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. In biblical times, the armies of the Elohim were the armies of the living God, just as the immortal saints will be the armies of the living God in the future when Babylon the Great and Russia and other enemies fall. David thus understood that the victory was from Yahweh and his Elohim, and Yahweh deserved, the honor of that victory. There was no excuse for what he was seeing play out on the battlefield. Certainly, Yahweh did not deserve the ignorant blasphemy of this giant of sin. Let's look at Psalm 34, verse 7. Psalm 34, 7. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. David understood this principle. So chapter 16, verse 37 is no surprise, or chapter 17, I guess. Even Saul gave in, relenting, as he could see that David's resolve was obviously set due to his faith and confidence in Yahweh. So Saul gives in, and he says, go, Yahweh be with thee. Let's look at over on this principle of David's resolve due to his faith and confidence in Yahweh. Let's look at John chapter 5, verse 19. Then answered Jesus and said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he seeth the Father do. For what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. In John chapter 14, verse 10. Believest thou not that I am in the Father, and the Father in me? The words that I speak unto you, I speak not of myself, but the Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the works. David was a man who understood these types of principles. He understood that Yahweh was with him. Saul, however, was still not entirely comfortable with the situation. He says, go, Yahweh be with thee. But then he hesitates for a moment, if you will. Look at verses 38 and 39 in 1 Samuel 17. Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass upon his head. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, I have not proved them. And David put them off him. Saul had given in to David's emotional speech, which, as a side note, as we'll find in later studies, was a weakness of Saul. He was often a man who was driven by emotion instead of facts. And so there are times when he breaks down in emotion in responding to David's speeches, David's heartfelt speeches, you might say, because they were. And so he'll say, oh, my son David, you know, or whatever, and may turn away from persecuting him or what have you. And then the next chapter, you'll see him persecuting David again. So he was a very emotion-driven man, and that's something that we see throughout his life. Anyway, in this case, his giving in was for good through the will of the Father. Nonetheless, he was not content with David going unarmed. Thus, Saul gave over his armor, including a helmet of brass, a coat of mail, and a sword. Yet, what was this David's true armor? Remember back in verses 4 through 7, Goliath had a great coat of mail and a helmet of brass, representing earthly protection and fleshly thinking. Later in verse 51, we will also see reference to Goliath's sword of the flesh. No, David was not interested in the weapons of the flesh. Truly, his armor was far greater. He bore the armor of righteousness, as described in the New Testament. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 6, verse 7. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 7. By the word of truth, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left. In Ephesians 6, 11 through 18. Ephesians chapter 6, 11 through 18. Put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the diabolos. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. Stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace, above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. When we think about these characteristics we just read, we should think of David. At the greatest heights of his life, including in this chapter, he was a master swordsman of the Spirit. And he took a stand against Goliath with the shield of faith and the helmet of salvation as the weapons in which he trusted, not Saul's. So what did David do? He politely tells Saul that he had not proved the armor. The word proved here is the Hebrew nasah, N-A-S-A-H, N-A-S-A-H, which means to test, attempt, prove, or try. Brown Driver Briggs has put to proof or test. This was probably from both a literal and spiritual perspective. Remember that David was perhaps only 15 or 16 years old, maybe, whereas Saul was an aged warrior who stood head and shoulders above the rest. Remember when he was chosen as king, he was head and shoulders above. So truly, this armor would have been too large for him. This word is also used frequently in the Old Testament for times of testing. Certainly, David had not tested this literal armor, but he had tested the whole armor of God in his battles with the lion and the bear. He had the shield of faith. He had the helmet of salvation. Interestingly, David would later use this same word in Psalm 26, and we'd like to look at those couple verses there. Psalm 26, verses 1 and 2. Judge me, O Yahweh, for I have walked in my integrity. I have trusted also in Yahweh, therefore I shall not slide. Examine me, O Yahweh, and prove me. Prove me, try my reins and my heart. Admittedly, we should note back in 1 Samuel 17 that there is some ambiguity in the pronouns that are used in verses 38 and 39. And so there may be some differences of opinion on these particular verses. Again, look at verse 38 and 39. Did Saul simply clothe David with his, i.e. David's armor, the armor of a common soldier, or was it Saul's literal armor? Depending on the translation you look at, there are various takes on this verse. However, I would suggest that we certainly don't believe that David came into the camp with literal armor because he was not coming to fight. He was simply coming with bread and cheese for his brethren. He didn't have literal armor. This was all thrust upon him, so to speak. Also, if the literal armor was David's, he would have proved it and therefore could have worn it as it would have been his own. So in any case, again, there's a little bit of pronoun issues here, but I believe that these context clues show that this was actually Saul's literal armor. Again, he was an emotion-driven king. He made his decisions based out of emotion. And so the king, who certainly would not think to fight Goliath himself, gave David the best that he had, his own. This in its own right is very interesting to think about from the symbolism. Saul here gives David the covering of a king, thus foreshadowing how Saul's kingdom itself would eventually be transferred to David. Interestingly, and I think this is why we might be on the right track here, Jonathan, in the next chapter, will do something very similar, albeit voluntarily and with understanding of Yahweh's plan for the throne, providing quite a contrast between the father and son. Saul gives a covering to David in ignorance, whereas Jonathan gives a covering to David and a sign of willful submission. So I'm sure we'll get someday down the road. Not today. Okay, let's go back and read verse 40, 1 Samuel 17, verse 40. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag which he had, even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. This verse shows us the weaponry that David would choose, regardless of Saul's offerings. Here we see David chooses his staff, literally meaning a rod, staff, shoot, or stick. He thus went out with the weapon of a shepherd, who was used to working with the sheep. Of course, the literal staff was just a token or symbol of what is described over in Psalm 23, verse 4. Psalm 23, verse 4, should be a very familiar verse to everyone. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. David was going into the valley of the shadow of death. He was going down into the valley of Elah, at the boundary of blood. Typically, this valley of the shadow of death, as it were. But his mind, David's mind, trusted in Yahweh's rod and staff. When we talked about Psalm 23 some time ago, we looked at these more in depth, and we believe that Yahweh's rod has to do with the rod of correction and his staff, the staff of sustenance. The rod of correction and the staff of sustenance that Yahweh could provide. Is there any doubt that when David eventually wrote Psalm 23, this event would have certainly been on his mind? In addition to his staff, David chose five smooth stones. There are so many different angles from which we can look at this, and this morning we have a few suggestions. This is a very, very much discussed part of this chapter, and there's a lot of meaning here. Okay, so just a few suggestions. First of all, five is, of course, the number of biblical number of grace, as it is by Yahweh's grace that the victory would be gained. That's a very simple look at it, and I think that's correct. Secondly, there was a stone for each of the five major Philistine cities, Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. These five cities of the flesh would be judged through Yahweh's grace. Keep in mind, we talked about last time, the hidden meaning in the names of the five cities. The powerful, ravaging, strong one shall be weighed in the balances, trodden down in the winepress, and torn up by the roots. If you take those five names of the Philistine cities and put them together, it means the powerful, ravaging, strong one shall be weighed in the balances, trodden down in the winepress, and torn up by the roots. Goliath was about to learn this lesson, as will his latter-day counterpart, Nebuchadnezzar's image. Another interesting view of the five smooth stones is that there was one stone for each of the books of the Pentateuch that David regularly washed in. Collectively, these five books provided the water of the word that was available at that time. They didn't have the full Bible that we have today, of course. They had the Pentateuch. Of course, the word, the Bible, is the book in which each of us should regularly wash so that we can have our rough edges smoothed out by the actions of the brook and thereby develop into smooth and polished stones. Ephesians 5, 25 and 26. Ephesians chapter 5, 25 and 26. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the ecclesia and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. As an interesting side note, the psalmist indicates that David also drank of the water of this life-giving stream that polished the stones. So sort of Psalm 110, there's so much in Psalm 110, but let's just turn over there and look at that one verse. Verse 7. He shall drink of the brook in the way, therefore shall he lift up the head. Very prophetic, of course, of the work of Christ in this entire psalm. But I think you could also see this detail that probably happened in 1 Samuel 17. Drinking of the brook in the way, therefore he would lift up the head. In any case, these various looks at the stones give us something, some very interesting and important thoughts to keep in mind. So we see the by the grace of Yahweh, sin would fall. There's one stone for each of the Philistine cities that would be judged. And of course, the meanings of those names are very important. And there's five stones for each of the books of the law, which would be the water by which David himself and all those other faithful Israelites would be polished. And there's more that we're going to get into. We may, when we get into the one stone and the four, which will come later. Okay, so what did David do next? Verse 40 tells us that he puts these stones in the shepherd's bag. again identifying the beloved as a shepherd, even in a scrip. This is a word that we do not often use today, the scrip, that is, and it means a traveling pouch for gleanings, a traveling pouch for gleanings. And it comes from a root word that means to gather or glean, to gather or glean. The scrip is a place where the gleanings from the field would be kept. So you think about Ruth going out to get the gleanings from the field and putting them in the scrip. In this particular situation, David had cleaned polished stones representing the faithful ones that are washed by the word and chosen by God, gleaned from among men. And thus with his selected or gleaned stones, staff, scrip, and sling, David went off to face the Philistine. Looking at verses 41 through 43 now. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, and ruddy, and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said to David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. In these verses before us, Goliath makes two fatal mistakes. First of all, Goliath saw only the staff in David's hands, but apparently was oblivious of the greater danger lurking in the shepherd's bag. His pride blinded him, as he judged only on the outward appearance. This will be a part of his undoing. So too, the image empire of Daniel chapter 2 will have no respect for Yahweh's chosen stone and his reservists, held in the scrip for future judgments. Additionally, I think there is an interesting connection to Habakkuk, where we read that there will be a hiding of the power of Christ and his saints until it is too late for the enemy to retreat. Let's look at Habakkuk 3:3-4. So again, when Goliath sees David coming, he doesn't see the stone power. He just sees the shepherd with his staff. I think it's an important detail. Habakkuk chapter 3:3-4. God came from, and this is prophetic, so you can translate it also as shall come from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. The true power of David, of course, was Yahweh himself, but in terms of the instrument that would undo Goliath, it was the stone. It was hidden. That power was hidden until it was time to be manifest in the full defeat of Goliath. So too with Nebuchadnezzar's image, which will stand up and do its work, and it will be too late once the stone is headed its way. Returning to the account in the Valley of Elah, Goliath asks, Am I a dog? Well, yes, Goliath, you are a dog, and about to be a dead dog, too. It's interesting that while Goliath says this statement in pride, David would later say something similar, yet in utmost humility, while dealing with Saul. And I think this is an important reference. 1 Samuel 24, verses 14 and 15. 1 Samuel chapter 24, 14 and 15. After whom is the king of Israel come out? After whom dost thou pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? Yahweh therefore be judge, and judge between me and thee, and see, and plead my cause, and deliver me out of thy hand. In either passage, Yahweh would be the judge, and ultimately he would deliver his beloved in both passages from the hand of the enemy. Goliath pridefully shouts, Am I a dog? Whereas David would say, Are you come out after a dead dog? After a flea, shows quite a contrast in character. Note that back in 1 Samuel, Goliath cursed David by his pagan gods. This is important and his second major mistake. The giant aimed its malicious words against the beloved shepherd boy, but ultimately his malice was against the God in whom David trusted, Yahweh God Almighty, and Yahweh is not mocked. Vengeance would be Yahweh's. He would repay, saith the Lord. And note that Goliath sets a pattern here. A pattern that will be copied when Gog comes down on the mountains of Israel. This will not only be a geopolitical war with Russia and her allies seeking to cleanse the Jews from the land. Oh, sorry, I missed a line and messed that whole sentence up. Okay, this will not only be a geopolitical war with Russia spearheading the nations against Israel, but it will also be a religious war. It is a religious war one in which Russia and her allies will seek to forever cleanse the Jews from the land and claim the Holy Land under their apostate arms. Goliath thus reminds us of that mouth of Daniel's fourth beast, speaking blasphemies against Yahweh and his people. Let's look at Daniel chapter 7, starting at verse 8. Daniel chapter 7, starting at verse 8. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns, plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things, or great blasphemy. Turning over to verse 20. And of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. In verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given to his hand until a time and times and a dividing of time. Also, Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 6. Revelation 13, verses 1 through 6. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads were the names of blasphemy. For sake of time, I'll just skip to verse 5. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. While this is a different time period spoken of here in Revelation 13, it nonetheless is a consistent theme of this fourth beast system, whether it be manifest in ancient Rome or Babylon the Great to come. It is a system of blasphemy, just like Goliath was a man of blasphemy, cursing David by his gods. Let's go back now to verses 44 and 45 of the 1 Samuel 17. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air, and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. If Goliath had been smart, he should have gotten the chills of that and run, but he didn't. In these verses, we see that the intention of the Philistine was to give David's flesh to the fowls of the air and the beasts of the field, just as Gog's intent will be in a day yet future. We'll look at some relevant verses on this point in our third talk this afternoon, but we'll skip those for now. Yet how does David react? David recognizes that Goliath is coming to him with the weapons of the flesh as a giant representative of sin, but David proclaims where his faith belongs. He comes in the name of Yahweh of armies, the Elohim of the armies of Israel. This is important for several reasons. First, it shows that David's faith was firmly rooted in Yahweh's law, which clearly told the Hebrews that Yahweh would be with them and fight their battles if they would only let faith cast out their fear. We already read it this morning, but Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 1 to 4, make this clear. Note that as we discussed in a previous talk, this was a pre-battle exhortation that the priest was to give the people, one that Saul should have arranged with the priest. Yet even though these things did not happen at the Valley of Elah for the army of Israel, David remembered where his trust should belong. He had been washed in the water of the brook and shows a character, even at a young age, that was much polished in comparison to his earthly king. While David likely had the words of Deuteronomy in mind when he went out to battle, giving him both strength and courage for the time ahead, his inspired response is also clearly prophetic. What name does David invoke in verse 45? He says, I came to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. In the Hebrew, this could be translated as, he who shall be armies, the mighty ones of the armies of the prince of the mighty one. Again, in the Hebrew, he who shall be armies, the mighty ones of the armies of the prince of the mighty one. In other words, this is a prophetic title which ultimately points forward to Yahweh, manifest through the army of his son and his saints, which will someday, hopefully soon, go out to battle for the Yahweh name. It is worth noting that the prince referenced here in this prophetic title is none other than Jesus himself. He is notably called the Prince of Peace in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. He is the captain of our salvation in Hebrews 2, verse 10. As this verse shows, Jesus, Hebrews 2, verse 10, that is, Jesus was made perfect through sufferings, most especially his death on the crucifixion stake. It is his sacrifice that provided the individual victory for himself and prepared a way for bringing many sons to glory. His individual victory on the field of battle with sin would thus allow for the victory of a future host that he will command, as prophesied in this phrase that David uses, "He who shall be armies, the mighty ones of the armies of the prince of the mighty one." He was that prince. He is that prince. So again, the individual victory of Christ on the field of battle with sin will thus allow for the victory of a future host that he will command, going out conquering in the future age as the head of the armies of the prince of the mighty one. These things are summed up well through a series of verses in Daniel chapter 8 and 9, which is what we're going to conclude with this morning. Daniel, let's start in chapter 8, verses 9 through 11. Daniel chapter 8, verses 9 through 11. "And one of them came forth a little horn out of one of them. It waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and to the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them." This is talking about the Roman power. "Yea, he magnified himself against the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down." We'll come back to Daniel 8 in a second, but let's skip to Daniel 9, verses 25 to 27. "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease," and so forth. So Messiah here was to be cut off, and you may see in your margin that phrase that "not for himself" could be translated "and shall have nothing." He had no sins to his charge. He bore the sin, the same nature as we do, the nature of Adam, but he had no personal transgressions. He did die, of course, to provide atonement for himself and for others. He confirmed the covenant, and he caused the sacrifices and so forth to cease. Turning back to chapter 8, verses 24 and 25, now we look forward to the future day. "By his power shall be mighty." This is talking about the king of Think about the Roman power in the latter days. "And his power shall be mighty, and not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. But this is the climax of it all. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken without hand." Just like David and Goliath, so too with Christ in this Roman system. With a memorial service now before us, these verses are a good segue, so we'd like to stop here, and we'll pick up this morning in 1 Samuel, or this afternoon rather, in 1 Samuel 17:46 for our last class. Thank you.